Now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to be with us on the Thursday already. Wow, week's flying by, huh? Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's an Ask the Lawyer Day today. It's one of our more popular features that we do periodically throughout the year. And we do it in cooperation with the Butler County Bar Association and the executive director there, Janice Hackett. We're very pleased to welcome and chat today with Phil Lope, a local attorney from the firm of Lope Kasker in Zelianople. Phil, good to have you here.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. You've been practicing law in our area for quite a while.
That's right. I was admitted to practice in 1974, moved to Zelianople in 1976, and so I've practiced in Butler County since 1976.
Are you originally from this area?
No, I'm originally from Johnstown in Cambria County, but I went to law school in Pittsburgh at Duquesne University, and then I went to work with a large law firm in Pittsburgh. They encouraged the associates there to open their own offices, meet clients at night and that sort of thing. And we liked the Zelianople area. We liked the country and ended up living there and then ultimately decided to make a career there and not go into Pittsburgh every day.
Your law firm, and I don't know what the proper terminology is, general practice. I mean, you operate in a wide variety of areas, do you not?
That's generally right, Dave. I do a lot of municipal work. A daughter of mine who's in the firm, Katie Kasker, she does almost exclusively wills and estates and elder law. I have a son-in-law, Steve Kasker, who's in the firm, and he does general practice. He does a lot of real estate work, personal injury work, criminal work. And there's another fellow in the firm by the name of Chris Reese, and he has a general practice also. He just does a little bit of everything.
Real estate work would be pretty big business in Zelianople and the southwestern Butler County area. There's been tremendous development there over the past couple of decades.
That's exactly right. And just to that point, when I moved to Zelianople, I was asked to represent the Cranberry Township Zoning Hearing Board. And I think I was a young lawyer, and I think they asked me to represent them because there was nothing going on in Cranberry Township in 1976, 77. There was one stoplight at Freedom Road in 19. So they hired me. Since that, and I'm still the solicitor for the Zoning Hearing Board in Cranberry, but you can imagine all the zoning issues that have developed over time. I think as of today, there are 47 stoplights in Cranberry Township. When I started representing Cranberry Township, there were 2,500 residents. Now there are 30,000, and they say that by the year 2030, there will be 50,000 people in Cranberry Township.
Wow.
So it's changed dramatically over the years. But many, many legal developments there, many legal issues that have developed as a consequence of all of that growth.
I want to talk about some personal law issues here momentarily, but since you've focused a great deal on municipal law in recent years, let's talk about that. Cranberry Township obviously has been one of the fastest growing areas of Butler County for two or three decades, and zoning laws were critical with growth like that. But it's not mandatory, right? Some more rural areas, rural townships or small towns, they don't necessarily all have zoning laws, do they?
That's exactly right.
I mean, it's not mandatory.
You don't have to have a zoning ordinance. A lot of municipalities, particularly the more rural ones, don't have any zoning because the theory is that a person should be able to use their land however they want to use it, and there shouldn't be any restrictions on the use of land. But that becomes problematic if you have a neighbor who abuses that and maybe uses the property for junk storage or something that's just not compatible with residences.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like everything in the law, there has to be a balance somewhere between no zoning and a zoning ordinance that recognizes the individual's right to use his own property, but not to the detriment of the neighbor or adjoining.
But if there's no zoning, you know, I mean, theoretically, a paper mill could be constructed right beside your property, or perhaps more realistically these days, a developer could come in and purchase a number of parcels and start putting in a housing development or something, and as a homeowner, you would have no recourse.
That's exactly right. And I think the bigger problem there is that if you don't have any regulation, if you don't have any direction on how you can use a property, then someone can develop an industrial site in a residential, what you would think would be a residential area, mm-hmm. or you could have a car dealership in the middle of a residential area. Those uses are not compatible. The idea with zoning is to put compatible uses in certain districts in the municipality. Have your industrial uses in another district in the municipality. Have your retail in another district. And today, you try to combine those uses to a certain point, to the extent they're compatible. But that's the idea. If you don't have those kind of restrictions, then all bets are off, mm-hmm. and anybody can do whatever they want with their property.
Can you grandfather stuff in, or is that where it gets problematic from your point of view, from a legal standpoint now? Say there was a car dealership. I know in the city of Butler, in decades gone by, most of the car dealerships were right downtown.
Yeah.
In fact, someone told me once there was Worsley's company had a warehouse on, that would have been on East Wayne Street. The building burned down some years ago, mm-hmm. 10, 15 years ago. And someone told me that used to be the Hudson auto dealership way back when. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the reasons why they thought it was such a bad fire, because some residue and stuff in there, you know, when it was a car dealership. Mm-hmm. Can you have what, I don't know what the term is for that, spot zoning, or can you grandfather something in when you rezone an area?
Yeah. That is called a non-conforming use. It's not spot zoning, but it's a non-conforming use. And typically you think of it as grandfathering in the use.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the use, the car dealership, in Zillionople we had a car dealership on Newcastle Street next to the municipal building, in the middle of residences, was Chuck Smith Ford. And it was there before the zoning ordinance was enacted. So if the use exists prior to the enactment of the ordinance, then by law it has the right to continue that use. And you can even change the use. You can go from the car dealership to another commercial use, as long as it's not egregious, as long as it isn't any more offensive to the area than the original use. And those uses can continue in perpetuity. So it's not uncommon to see a gas station in a residential district, a car dealership in a residential or commercial district. And there are different ways that municipalities try to deal with that. But you don't want incompatible land uses, mm-hmm. like the car dealership in a residential district.
So there's generally, what, three kinds? There's commercial, zoning, industrial, and residential? Of course, there's subsets in residential, right?
Yeah, there are all kinds of spin-offs of those uses.
Mm-hmm.
There's residential where you're only permitted to have single-family homes. Then there are residential where you're permitted to have single-family and multifamily. And then there are residential where you have a third kind of residential use that isn't either of those two. So there's spin-offs on all of those. Same thing with industrial uses, same mm-hmm. thing with commercial uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking with Phil Lope. He's a local attorney with the firm of Lope Kasker in Zillionople. That's the lawyer day today. I'd like to talk a little bit, if it's okay with you, in general terms about wills and estate planning, because this is of concern to a lot of people. You know, we see the demographics, Phil, from baby boomers who are, many of them now in their senior years or soon approaching that. And a lot of questions arise, you know, when you reach that stage of your life. So, first of all, let's talk about a will. Why is it advisable for anyone and everyone to have a will? Some folks think, well, I don't have a lot of money. I'm not Warren Buffett. What do I need a will for?
Sure.
Everybody needs one, right?
Well, I think that's generally true. And the idea with the will is that you direct how your assets are disposed of at the time of your death. You say where the assets go, as opposed to the state dictating the distributive scheme of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And a will doesn't have to be a Warren Buffett will or a Donald Trump will or anything complicated. It's a simple statement of, when I pass, this is who I want to receive whatever it is I own at the time of death. And that's what the will is intended to do. And also in the will, you name somebody to see that this is all taken care of, and that's called the executor. And the executor's role, and it can be a close family member, it can be a friend, it doesn't need to be an institution. The executor's role is to simply collect all of the assets at the time of death, pay whatever bills there are, and distribute the net estate to whomever you've named in the will to be the beneficiary. It's a simple process.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when we talk about wills, we talk about two other documents, estate planning tools. One is a power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
and that's a document that says that if I'm physically or I'm mentally unable to handle my affairs, then you appoint someone to handle them for you. You say that I appoint my spouse, typically is the first to act, and if she can't serve as my agent for whatever reason, maybe she's predeceased me, then you name an alternate. And that person then stands in your shoes if you're not capable of making those kind of decisions. And a lot of times people will say, well, how do I know that they're not going to abuse that power, that they're not going to just clean out my checking account?
Yeah.
They're, like anything, you assume that the person you appoint is a trustworthy person and they're going to do the right thing. If you don't have that familiarity with that person or that confidence in that person, then you can prepare what is called a springing power of attorney. And that's a power of attorney that comes into effect only when a certain event occurs. And typically, the springing power of attorney requires a physician to certify that you're incapacitated. And then in that case, the agent has the authority to step up and take care of your business.
It's a term that I've not heard of before. Yeah. Springing power.
Springing
of attorney.
Springing power, yeah. It's not used as commonly as a general power of attorney, and the reason for that is because it's sometimes difficult to get a physician to certify that someone is incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doctors don't like to make that determination unless it's crystal clear.
In many cases, I would imagine a parent would designate a son or a daughter for power of attorneys.
Yeah, generally the way it works is that the husband will appoint the wife will appoint the husband, and then the document will say, if they can't do it, then I appoint my oldest son or my oldest daughter, and that's generally the scheme.
So you mentioned two documents that are commonly drafted in addition to a will. One of them, power of attorney. What's the other one?
The third document is called a health care power of attorney. And that document generally says that if I'm in a permanent vegetative state, if the physician says that it's not likely that I'm going to recover from this condition that I'm in,
mm-hmm.
Then you indicate in this form whether you want any kind of heroic treatment to keep you alive. Do you want transfusions? Do you want to be put on a ventilator? Do you want any number of things that are listed in the document? But that's called a health care directive, or a living will, typically. Is
that was a term they used to use.
It. Yeah.
Probably a little bit more accurate to say health care directive.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think some people worry about that because So they get this drafted from their attorney, a health care directive, and then they say, well, what, you know, what if I change my mind? As I understand it, that only kicks in if the person is, you know, in a coma or on a, as long as you're awake and able to talk,
sure,
you still make the decision,
you
right?
You make the calls, absolutely. And it's the same thing with a power of attorney. Mm-hmm. As long as you're competent, you make the call. And one of the important things with the living will is, in the living will, it will say, John Smith, I'm John Smith, and if I'm in a permanent vegetative state, if I'm not going to recover consciousness, if I'm not going to have any quality of life, I do or do not want certain treatments, and they're all listed. And then it'll say, and if there's any doubt about my intentions in this regard, I want the person that I've named here, and you list somebody as mm-hmm. your surrogate, somebody to make those decisions in your place. And typically that's the wife, and then it'll, or the husband, and then it will say, and if they're not around to do it, then I want these people to have the authority to make these decisions for me. And in that regard, it's real important, Dave, to talk with your kids and talk with your spouse back and forth about what you do want in those end-of-life situations. Most people will say, I don't want to be kept alive on a ventilator. You know, if I'm not capable of having some kind of quality of life, pull the plug, please. But those are important issues, and you have to talk about all of that.
We're chatting with Phil Lope. He's a local attorney. His office is Lope Kasker in Zelianople. If you have any questions on these issues, feel free to join us. Join in the conversation. Our phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525, if you would like to ask the lawyer. 283-2525. Why do you think some people put off making a will? It's because they don't want to think about their death. Not an easy thing to do, but
yeah.
Nobody's getting out of here alive, Phil.
I think we're procrastinators generally, and mm-hmm. so we put it off and we put it off, and then the point that you mentioned, Dave. People think, well, I don't have the big estate, so I really don't need a will. And I think that's generally why people postpone that. But it's so simple to make up a will. It's so simple. And the other side of the coin is, if you don't have a will, that's called an intestate death. And what that means is that
The state
directs the beneficiaries of your estate. Now, it's not as if the state, a lot of people think, well, if I don't have a will, the state's going to get everything. It doesn't work that way. The intestate law says, if you don't have a will, here's how your estate is going to be distributed. If you're married and you have children, the estate gets divided between the spouse and the children. If you don't have a spouse, then it gets divided between the children. If you don't have children, then it goes to your siblings, and it spreads out like a tree. But that may not be, and that's all fine, because that'll take care of your distribution, but those may not be the people that you want to receive what you have.
Yeah. Let's take a call if you have questions. Our phone number is 283-2525. Hi there, caller. Thanks for waiting. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Phil Lope.
I would like to know when a property is left to the kids,
mm-hmm.
and everyone has passed away but the one, and the one owns the sixth kid owns the whole thing because they bought their property off, and I wanted to know about the one that's left, and then the one that owns the sixth properties, who has a say-so about when you sell it?
Well, we're a little bit confused about six kids and there's only one that's still alive. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's one that had bought all the property but one. So that means that there's six properties belong to the one person. And then there's one part of it that belongs to the one that's still living. And I wondered, when they bought the six properties, what about the seventh one? Does they have as much say-so as the other one that bought the properties?
So
from the other kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear what Attorney Phil Lope has to say here.
If I understand the facts, let's say there are seven beneficiaries, and six of those pieces of property are owned by, or six of those shares are owned by one person.
Yes.
And another person owns one share.
Yes.
And unlike many things, it's not where you have a majority vote and the majority decides. What has to happen in that case is, if there cannot be agreement between the two property owners, then that's what's called a partition action. And what that means is, unfortunately, you have to go to the court and say that we can't agree, judge, on the sale of this property. And then the judge will say, well, there's a procedure in the law to deal with that, and that means that we investigate whether the property can possibly be divided. Can we take 6/7 of it and sell it, and the other person retain the 1/7 and not destroy the value of either party's interest? Or is it necessary to sell the whole thing? Or different spin-offs of that notion. One can buy out the other six. The person that has the six shares can buy out the one share. But unfortunately, if they, and ideally what happens is that they get together and they reach some agreement. And if they can't reach an agreement, then that means you have to go to court. And the court then will decide what's fair with regard to the ownership and the sale of the property.
Does that help you out, caller?
Yes. Thanks a lot. And I'll go with what you're saying.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. That's a good question. Good question. Let's go to this line next. Our phone number is 283-2525. If you would like to ask the lawyer, 283-2525. Caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Phil Lope. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is, my father-in-law has dementia, and my wife is a power of attorney. Now, when his home is actually sold, is he going to have to pay taxes on the money that he's getting from the home?
Well, I'm not a tax expert, but my thought is that if it's his principal residence, he has a $250,000 exemption in terms of reporting any capital gain on the sale of the residence. So if the home is the principal residence and he sells it for less than $250,000, then he won't be responsible for payment of any federal capital gains tax.
Okay.
Is that responsive to your question?
Were you talking about capital gains or inheritance tax, sir? Hello? Nope, we lost him. We lost his cell there. You can give us a call back if you have more of a question there, but your cell just died on us. 283-2525 is the number. We owe for a break at any rate, so let's just take it right here, and we'll come back and continue our conversation. It's Ask the Lawyer today. You're on It's Your Turn on WISR, and we'll be back after these words.
In 2019, Tri-Rivers celebrates 25 years as your Butler neighbor, providing exceptional musculoskeletal care in the community.
I'm Dr. Scott Rainey, an orthopedic back and neck surgeon at Tri-Rivers. Whether I'm in the office treating patients for conditions such as cervical or lumbar stenosis, or in the operating room performing innovative procedures like disc replacements, I'm proud to care for patients in the Butler community. To learn more or to schedule an appointment, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way, getting there starts here.
Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
It's time to celebrate the fall season with supplies from Osterling's Lawn and Garden. They have a huge selection of fall and Halloween decorations like pumpkins, corn stalks, and mums. Their fall flower bulbs are in, including the ice cream tulip, tulip mixes, crocus, and more. This time of year is great to plant grass seed, lime, and fertilize your lawn. And they have Lignetics hardwood pellets in stock to help keep the heat on for those cool fall nights. Kick off the fall season at Osterling's Lawn and Garden, where they'll have everything you'll need at a great price.
Welcome back, good friends. It's the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. It's an Ask the Lawyer day today. Ask the Lawyer. Attorney Phil Lope is here. His practice is at the law firm of Lope Kasker in Zelianople. Our phone number, if you'd like to ask the lawyer, 283-2525, 283-2525. And Phil, we lost that last caller. His cell conked out on us before we were finished, and I just wanted to make sure that people understood the difference between capital gains tax on a property if you sell your house, if that was your principal residence, and inheritance tax, because that's a different story. Mm-hmm. And it depends on who inherits the house, right? Whether it's a spouse or kids or whatever. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, be glad to. And just to go back to that last caller, I assumed that the sale of the home took place prior to the death of the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sell it during your lifetime, then you have those capital gains consequences that we talked about. Now, if you own the home at the time of death, then that's a different tax situation to look at. And that's where the inheritance tax comes into play. And at the time of death, there are two taxes that are relevant. One is the federal tax. Just like with our income, there's a federal tax, mm-hmm. and there's a state inheritance tax. The federal tax laws have changed over my law career, and they've changed dramatically recently, so that if your individual estate is less than, in round numbers, $11.5 million, then there's no federal tax consequence.
That would be most people.
Yeah,
I think
statistically that's about 99% of the population don't have any federal tax issues. In the old days, that was an issue because the exemption was only $650,000, then it went to $1 million, and so there were a lot of people that had federal tax consequences, so you needed to do some estate planning to minimize that tax. But in any event, most people don't have to face that issue. But the Pennsylvania inheritance tax, that applies whether your estate's $1,000 or $1 million. You have to pay Pennsylvania inheritance tax, mm-hmm. except where your property passes to a spouse. Generally, you find that property is owned by a husband and wife together. For example, the home is usually in the husband's name and the wife's name. The bank accounts are generally in both names.
Mm-hmm.
And where that's the case, Dave, on the death of the first to die, the property will automatically go to the surviving spouse by operation of law. There's nothing you can say in a will that will change that. And most importantly, there are no tax consequences to that transfer. The tax comes into play when the property leaves the husband and wife and passes on to the children or whomever the beneficiaries are. And the Pennsylvania inheritance tax rate depends on the identity of the beneficiary. If it passes to our lineal descendants, our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, then the tax rate is 4.5% of the net estate. And the net estate is determined by taking all of the assets, paying all of the bills, and what's left you pay tax at 4.5%. If it goes to people other than the children, then for example, your siblings, then the tax rate would be 12%. And if it goes to unrelated individuals, then the tax rate is 15% of the net estate.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So Are there things that you can do by meeting with an attorney to make sure that you're on the right path here, you know, in terms of estate planning? Because for a lot of folks that don't deal with this on a regular basis, you know, your head can start spinning here. Sure. Your eyes can start glazing over when you talk about this.
Sure, and you can get involved in estate planning with the idea of minimizing the tax that you have to pay, the idea of making the distribution to the beneficiary simple. I always recommend to clients that they have an inventory of everything that they own so that the person that handles their affairs doesn't have to recreate their life and figure out where did they do their banking, where do they own real estate, who do they want to receive these personal property items. It's real important that you talk with your kids about that sort of thing, mm-hmm. so that it's not a difficult process for them when they have to act, because at that point it's really an emotional situation, and you can have 10 different opinions from 10 different kids as to how your folks wanted it taken care of.
Now, you mentioned earlier that in the vast majority of cases, a house, a property is owned jointly with
a
husband and wife. But if you're talking about preparing a will, then both spouses need to do that, right? The husband needs a will and the wife needs a will too.
That's exactly right, yeah. And the wills generally mirror each other. The husband's will, generally speaking, says everything I have goes to my wife. Mm-hmm. If she predeceases me, then I want it to go to the kids in equal shares. If anything happens to any of the kids, their share would go to their children if they had children. And then you name an executor. Wife's will say generally the same thing. Give everything to my husband, then children, then lineal descendants. That's called a prosterpial distribution. And you name an executor, a person to see that it's all taken care of, like we mentioned before.
Can you change an executor after you've already made a will?
And that's the thing that I tell people all the time. The will doesn't become fixed until the time of death. So between the time that you sign that will and the time that it becomes effective, you can change it as many times as you want. People will exclude people that they named in the original will, mm-hmm. they'll add people to it. They'll put the church in. They'll change it over and over again during their lifetime, and they're certainly free to do that. It doesn't become fixed until death.
It's Ask the Lawyer. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions, you can feel free to join us. The phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525. Attorney Phil Lope is with us here on the program today. If you want to change a will, say you made a will, whatever, 15, 20 years ago, 5 years ago, do you have to go to the same attorney that you originally went to if you want to change your will?
No, that's not necessary. A lot of times what we will find is that a couple prepared a will when they had their first child, and they name guardians in the will to take care of the child's physical person, the guardian of the person, mm-hmm. as well as they name someone to take care of the estate, the guardian of the estate. Well, generally, that they outgrow that will because the kids are now adults. They don't need to have guardians. They don't need to have a trust fund for the kids. So they'll change the will. Very, very simple, easy thing to do. Or if you want to make a simple amendment to your will or a simple modification, that's called a codicil. And you make up a codicil and it says, I changed paragraph 5 of my will where I named John Smith to be the executor. He's passed away and I want Mary Jones to be the executor. That's called a codicil. And the misconception that people have is that you have to go to the attorney that drafted the will to administer the estate, or you need to go to the attorney who drafted the will if you want to prepare a codicil. That should not be a deterrent for people. They can go to anyone they want, as anybody that they're comfortable with. Just because I prepared a will for someone in 1975 they don't know me anymore. They've moved on. They should feel free to go to anybody they want to go to address whatever the need is.
Can you have specific things in a will? For example, and we're speaking hypothetically here. Let's say, you know, you said in your will that I want my estate to be divided equally among my children, my three kids, whatever number. Could you still specify within that, say a mom had specific pieces of jewelry yeah. that she wanted to make sure went to a specific daughter, or maybe she was a seamstress and she wanted her sewing equipment, or the father was a woodworker and he wanted his tools to go. Could you spell all that out specifically
sure,
in there?
That's a very good point. And there are a couple of ways to do that. Sometimes in the will itself, the dad will say, well, I give my collection of guns to my oldest son, or the mom will say, I want my wedding ring to go to my daughter. Mm-hmm. You can do all of that in the will. It's very easy to do. The other way to do it is that the will say, I've prepared a memorandum that I'm keeping with this will, and in that memorandum I've listed the personal property that I want to dispose of. And so they'll make up a list and they'll say, I want the guns to go to John, I want the wedding ring to go here. And that's easier to do than put it in the will, because if circumstances change, you don't want to have to change the will. It's easier to change that memo and make up a new memo and just keep it with your will. But to your point, Dave, that is not at all uncommon. You know, there are things that have a lot of, maybe not monetary value, but a lot of sentimental value you want to keep in the family, or it meant a lot, this particular car meant a lot to my son because we worked on it together. All that sort of thing can be done in a will. Very, very easy to do.
Mm-hmm. And then after you took care of that specific stuff, you could say, all the rest of my estate gets divided equally among the...
That's right. And, you know. And just to that point, what the executor generally does is he turns everything into cash, and then he divides it the way the will says. But it doesn't have to work that way. If the decedent had a home or a piece of property or 40 acres in Lancaster Township, any of the beneficiaries can say, hey, instead of selling that and dividing the money, I want to buy that from the estate, or I want to take that 40 acres as my share of the estate. It doesn't have to be reduced to cash. All of that can be worked out in the estate administration.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about common questions with regard to preparation of a will, power of attorney, and advanced health care directive. With attorney Phil Lope visiting with us. If you have questions, you can join us at 283-2525, 283-2525. What is probate, and does every will have to go through probate? First of all, what is it?
Probate is the process of filing the will in the office of the Register of Wills and having an executor appointed, the person that's named in the will, who's charged with administering the estate. That's generally speaking, that's the probate process. You get the blessing of the court to handle this estate. If you don't have an executor, then you don't have a person with any authority to administer and liquidate the West Banco account, or sell the home in Parker, or do any of the things that have to be done to wind up a person's affairs. The probate process is a process whereby the Register of Wills names the executor selected in the will to handle all of this.
Well, that's a great simple explanation for that a lot of people don't understand. Yeah. Because if you name an executor in your will, or an executrix,
right,
if it were a woman, then you don't have to go through probate, I guess, huh?
Well, no. That is the process. The Register of Wills will give the stamp of approval to the person that you've named in the will and says, Lope, I'm naming you the executor of this estate. And once I'm named, then I have the authority to go to the bank and liquidate the bank account. But that's the probate process. And people are afraid of that because they think, boy, I have to get an attorney, and that costs a lot of money. And they're just unfamiliar with it. But it's a really simple process.
Does all that become public knowledge?
It does. Yeah, it does. The inheritance tax return, which is an inventory, basically, of all of the decedent's assets and debts and expenses, that gets filed in the Register of Wills office, and that's a matter of public record. You can go in and look at the Hines estate and see what the Hines is owned if you want to, and in Allegheny County or in Butler County, you can look at the records there. I don't think many people do that, but it's possible. You could go in and look at them if you wanted to.
Most people take care of all three of these documents, a will, a power of attorney, and an advanced health care directive. They do this all in one fell swoop, right?
Generally, that's right. Yeah, that's what, when we talk to people, people will call in and say, hey, I want to prepare a will. And we explain to them that in addition to the will, we recommend that you have this and, you know, the power of attorney, the health care directive, or living will. And then what we'll do is make an appointment with the person to go over that those three issues. And between the time they call and the time of the appointment, we will send them out an estate planning questionnaire where we collect information from them, names, ages, what assets do you have, although we don't pin it down and we don't ask them for dollars and cents. We just want to have a range, so if we have a federal estate tax issue, we want to know about that. Or do you have someone with special needs? All of those kind of issues are in this estate planning questionnaire. And they will generally get that to us before that first meeting so that we can go over it, and now we can intelligently discuss their estate with them.
Let's take a break. We'll continue our conversation, informative conversation, with the local attorney, Phil Lope, visiting with us on It's Your Turn here today. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Hey, happy anniversary. They are celebrating this month of October, the 16th anniversary of their big move of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store to the Greater Butler Mart location, which is just south of the city of Butler on Route 8, you know where the Greater Butler Mart is. Yeah, they've been there for 16 years already. Keep in mind that every penny, all of the revenue generated by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store stays right here in Butler County to help support the needy and the less fortunate. It helps support their client aid program and their food bank services. So the folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul would like to pass out a big thank you to all the folks who have donated items over the years to the thrift store for sale to people, helping them generate funds for the food bank and for the client aid program. And thanks to all the folks who volunteer at the food bank, too. You have helped the Society of St. Vincent de Paul make a better life for many, many, many people here in the Butler County community. In fact, over the past 16 years, they've distributed close to $1.4 million in client aid. And that simply helps a family with a heating bill at the end of the month, or a medical bill, or whatever. And their food bank, my goodness, now serving 1,600 people every month. Society of St. Vincent de Paul, here in Butler. They like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others.
Welcome your fall morning with the best fall breakfast at Michael's Restaurant. In the fall, mornings are chilly and you just don't want to get up. But head to Michael's Restaurant and savor their pumpkin pancakes, cornmeal mush, or their popular buckwheat pancakes. Breakfast lovers, it's worth getting out of bed for. I promise.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
The Battery Warehouse Plus family is proud to announce the opening of West End Tire and Service, formerly Seaman Tire Services. Keeping commerce alive in Butler is important, and at West End Tire and Service, they vow to keep the same great people and great service that Seaman's provided for years by offering a vast selection of tires, installation, and service. West End Tire and Service is looking forward to serving the community and expanding their service offerings in the near future. Stop by West End Tire and Service, 459 West Cunningham Street in Butler, or call 724-287-6973.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Welcome back, friends. It's Ask the Lawyer here on the It's Your Turn program today, and we're very pleased to be able to chat with local attorney Phil Lope from the law firm of Lope Kasker in Zelianople. We were talking about wills before the break there, Phil. So you visit your attorney and you get these three documents prepared, a will, a power of attorney, and an advanced health care directive. What do you do with them? Where do you put these documents?
We recommend to people that they keep them wherever they have their important papers. If they have a fireproof box at home, if they have a drawer where they have all of their papers, or a file room where they have all their papers, that's where I recommend that they keep them. A lot of times people will ask whether they should put them in the lock box at a bank. They'll have a safety deposit box at the bank. But I recommend that they don't keep them there, because at the time of death, that original will has to be located, and then it gets probated, as we talked before. And there are several hoops that you have to jump through to get into that lockbox at the bank. It's much simpler to have the will at home, where it's available to the executor. It's important that, as I mentioned before, that If your children are involved, you need to let them know where you keep your important papers. You need to let them know that there's an inventory prepared that lists all of your assets. I do my banking at this bank. I have this life insurance policy. Mm-hmm. It's easy to take care of, and it just solves a lot of headaches for the kids.
It's a good idea to put all of that stuff together. And, you know, there are books online, kind of like workbooks or worksheets, that help you go through this.
Sure.
If you want to Google that the next time you're online, and you can order one of these things, it helps you get started, because for a lot of people, you know, where do I start, for goodness sakes, in trying to gather all this info?
Sure, and it's intimidating for people.
Sure.
You know, the law is a mystery to a lot of people. They don't have a lot of occasion to be involved with that process, so it's intimidating. And when it's intimidating or overwhelming, seemingly overwhelming, we ignore it. We don't pay any attention to it. But if there's any point that I want to make, Dave, it's that the estate planning process is not complicated, and equally important, it's not expensive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to cost you an arm and a leg to prepare a will and a power of attorney and a living will. Those are standard documents that the attorney turns out.
It doesn't take very long either.
It shouldn't. No. Yeah. I mean, there are all different kinds of complexity. No estate is exactly the same as the next estate. You know, some people want to be very, very detailed in their will, and other people will say, whatever it is I own, I want it to be distributed equally this way. It can be anything that you want it to be, but the important point is it's not complicated and it's not expensive.
So people should not be intimidated for any reason. You know, another thing occurs to me, Phil, sometimes people are intimidated about consulting with an attorney because, well, in many cases, when you do that, there's some sort of trouble. You know, one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, someone has tripped on your sidewalk and, you know, there's a personal injury or whatever. It's kind of like meeting a state trooper. Most folks' interaction one-to-one with the state trooper is when something has gone wrong or there's, you know, there's big trouble somewhere. You shouldn't feel that way about an attorney, for goodness sakes, you know?
Well, that's exactly right. And I'm a little older than you are, and when we were growing up, we didn't know any attorneys. We never dealt with attorneys in our family. But in this day and age, I think I read where there's one attorney for every 500 people in Butler County. It seems as though we have a lot more interaction with attorneys today, just because there are so many more than there used to be. There are neighbors. They go to the same church that we do. We see them all the time, so we're not put off by them, or we're not in awe of them, for lack of a better word. We're familiar with them.
If someone, or a husband and wife, whatever, if they prepared wills some years ago, not a bad idea to review those on a regular basis with your attorney. Any recommendation on how often you should do that?
Well, I don't think, Dave, that there's any time line, but I think, and what I tell people is, depending on your circumstances, if your assets have changed over time, you know, then you need to look at your will and make sure that you're not going to have any untoward tax consequences. If your feelings about the beneficiaries that you've named have changed, then you need to revise your will. But the general rule is, if your circumstances change dramatically, then you have to revisit that will, whether it's 1 year after you drafted it or 10 years after you drafted it.
What if, hypothetical here, a man had prepared a will and then there was a divorce, you know, divorced his wife and got married again some years later, whatever. And he never changed his will. What would happen upon his death?
I'm not a family law guy. I don't have any experience with that, but I do believe that if you have named your wife in your will and you subsequently get divorced, I have to be careful with this, but I think she's automatically removed as a beneficiary. Unless you would draft a new will and name her again, notwithstanding the fact that you were divorced from her. But I do believe that there's a statute that says if she is named as a beneficiary and you're subsequently divorced, unless there's some affirmative action on your part to show that you intend for her to be a beneficiary and survive the divorce, then I believe she's automatically removed from the will.
And speaking of divorce, not necessarily with a spouse, but say you drafted your will 10, 15, 20 years ago, and there have been divorces among your beneficiaries. You know, say you had a son and a daughter, and you know, there's a divorce there, they're married to someone else. You might want to look at that to change that. So that's another good reason to review your will every so often.
That's exactly right. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, let's say hypothetically you have three children and they're all married, and they'll say, well, do we name our daughter-in-law or do we name our son-in-law as a beneficiary in the will? And that all depends on the relationship, and it all depends, at least in my mind, how long they've been together. Mm-hmm. If they're a young couple, God forbid something happens to your son, more likely than not, the daughter-in-law will remarry and begin her life all over again. So you may not want her to be a beneficiary of that will because she may no longer have a connection to the family.
Yeah.
It all depends on how long they've been married. It depends on whether there are any children. But generally, I caution against naming the spouse as a beneficiary of the will.
But you stick with the son and the daughter as opposed to son-in-law or daughter-in-law.
Exactly, and particularly if they have children, because generally our intended beneficiaries are our lineal descendants, our children, our grandchildren. We want our line to take over what we had. So as long as you have that proverbial distribution to the children, grandchildren, etc., then you've covered that.
What happens if you lose your will? Should your attorney have a copy of that? Do they keep a copy somewhere in a filing cabinet? Or I'm sure it happens.
It happens frequently, and that's a very good point. You have to produce the original document in order to have an executor appointed.
Uh-huh.
Now, people will lose that document. They'll move, and they will have had it in a box of papers, and when they move to the new house, somehow it got misplaced. Mm-hmm. So that's a big issue. And the law presumes in that case that they intended to destroy it.
Oh.
So that throws everything into chaos. Frequently, at least in our office, we always make a photocopy of the signed document. The client takes the original document and keeps it wherever they keep it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a photocopy so that if they want to change paragraph 1 or paragraph 5, we have it in front of us and we know what they're talking about when they call. But in addition to that, if they lose that original will, there is a procedure where you can offer the photocopy, but you have to prove to the court that it wasn't the testator, the maker of the will's intention to revoke it, and that more likely than not it was lost or misplaced.
Hmm.
And you do that through testimony from people who knew the decedent and so forth.
Boy, some great tips and advice and clarifications here in this area from our guest today, Attorney Phil Lope. He's with the law firm of Lope Kasker in Zeelanopolis. What's your address there in Zeelanopolis, Phil?
We are at 207 East Grandview Avenue in Zeelanopolis, and we've been in this location since 1984, in this office building since 1984.
Hmm.
Prior to that, we were at an address on Main Street.
Well, the bottom line is, for goodness sakes, never be afraid of or intimidated talking with an attorney about these or any other issues, because they know the law and most of us don't, and so they're there to help you. Now, if you need an attorney, if you don't have one, if you need an attorney for any of the things we've been discussing today or for any other reason, and again, you don't know one or don't have one, feel free to call the Butler County Bar Association. Janice Hackett is the executive director there, and she is super.
Wonderful person.
No question about it. She helps us schedule our attorneys for our program here today. But now, they will not recommend any specific attorneys, but they will give you a list of several whose law practice focuses in this area, whatever it might be, criminal law, personal injury, family law, whatever. And that'll get you started. They'll give you a list of some people that you could contact. So that's very easy to do. You just call them. You know, call the Butler County Bar Association. Phil Lope, enlightening and fun to talk with you today. I enjoyed the conversation a great deal.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah. Phil Lope visiting with us. Hey, coming up on tomorrow's program, we got a lot of good stuff, as usual, here on It's Your Turn. We've had a good week so far, haven't we? Yeah, we've talked with a lot of folks. We have people from the Musical Theater Guild of Butler, among other things, joining us on tomorrow's program as they get ready to open a new season. And many of our cultural groups are opening their new seasons here in this month of October. And the Musical Theater Guild is presenting, it's a fairly new musical, Mamma Mia. And it's not this weekend, it's next weekend that they'll be opening that show. But we'll have some guests with us tomorrow to tell you all about it. And some other stuff, too. Enjoy the rest of your day. Hope to see you tomorrow at 12:30 for the Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
I feel